Oral History Project, Youngstown State University, November 8, 1990. The subject is Youngstown State and the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War. The interviewee is Dr. Alice Budge, English Department, Youngstown State University. The interviewer is Matthew Butts. The interview is taking place at DeBartolo Hall, Youngstown State University, at approximately 4 p.m.
Okay, looks like we're ready to go. Could you tell me something about where you're from, your childhood, a little bit about your family?
Okay. I'm from New York City originally, and was born in 1940. My parents came there from West Virginia. My mother raised foster children. She was a nurse, and after she married, she raised foster children. And my father was a New York City policeman for many years in New York City, and moved from the rank of patrolman through inspector. He had an odd thing, which probably contributes to some of my interest in anti-war work, and that is that he tested with the lowest hostility quotient of any New York City policeman tested up till that time. So New York City had a lot of things that it did in terms of psychological battery of tests and so forth, and so had a low hostility rating. Also, my parents, especially as they got older, participated in a lot of different kinds of social causes, and I think that led to some extent to my interest in a number of these areas. Most recently, my mother, who is now ill, but even into her 70s, was working with the Battered Persons Crisis Center and the NAACP and ACLU and legal services and lots of different kinds of causes. And my father, although he's been dead since the 70s, was active in anti-Vietnam War work also.
Tell me about your educational background.
Okay. I went to public schools in New York City, and then went to Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. I graduated from high school in 1958 and went to this four-year liberal arts school that fall, graduated in 62, and went on to State University of New York at Buffalo. I was a major in psychology and sociology as an undergraduate, and originally went to school in psychology as a graduate student, but transferred to English because I had always loved it, and earlier thought the only thing I could do with it was to be a teacher, and who wanted to do that? However, I changed my mind. I graduated. I left there in 68 and came here, and my PhD was granted in 1970.
When did you say you first came to Youngstown State?
1968.
Okay. What was it like when you first came here? What was the university like in comparison to today?
Okay. Well, it was physically much more compressed and not as attractive, I think. It was just in the process of becoming a state university. So it had transferred from becoming a smaller private university to a state university. And one of the things that meant is that the university had to get PhDs, I think, to double their number in order to meet sort of state qualifications and requirements. So a lot of people were hired in 68, 69, and 70. And there are a whole crew of us now here who are senior professors. I mean, we're the old folks at this point. So that was, I think, a period of rapid change for the university and growth, becoming the state institution.
What was the composition of the student body like? Is it much a commuter, was it much a commuter school as it is today?
Yeah, I think so. And of course, there were a number of students, as there are now, living on the lower north side. And of course, Beagley wasn't even there, the gymnasium and so forth, and the Stambaugh Stadium, of course, wasn't there. And so there were a lot of students who used to live in this area, I'd say up and beyond Wick Park, even as there are now. But my impression is that there were clusters of sort of interest communities and so forth that lived together. People, as it turns out, of some social concern very often, especially as the anti-war movement grew. So, I guess the idea of a commuter school is what it was decidedly. I think in some ways not as many non-traditional students, although as I think back to that time, there were a number of returning veterans, Vietnam veterans, and so that added a different element and dimension to some of the things that were coming, the subject of our interview. Mm-hmm.
When did you first begin to question United States involvement in Southeast Asia?
Actually, it was kind of funny because I didn't always have a questioning attitude about what was going on. As I say, I came here in 1968, and there had been demonstrations at State University of New York at Buffalo, where I was a graduate student. But I mainly walked by them. I was somebody who was very absorbed in trying to get a dissertation done. I had two small children, and I think I was just very absorbed in my own life. When I came to Youngstown State University, there were two people here who were very influential in helping to change me, and that was Claudia Morrison and Chat Morrison. And they held sessions at their home and so forth, study groups, and she was in the English department, he was in the history department. They became very informed about what was going on and would encounter their colleagues, talk to them about this issue, as I said, set up study groups, try to get some witness, a peace vigil, something of this sort going, and people of real commitment. And I think there was a spread of effect from their knowledge, witnessing, concern, and commitment to others, and I was one of them. A second influence, I would say, was my parents, there are a few amusing stories related to that. My parents had retired by this time and had moved to Florida, and I used to go and want to go to Florida with my kids and just want to go and stay out on the beach and that sort of thing, you know, typical Florida vacation kind of thing in the springtime. And my father would insist that I go and hand out leaflets with him, sort of on the street corner in downtown St. Petersburg, and then I could go to the beach in the afternoon. So I had to do sort of my political commitment in the morning with him. And it was an odd thing because, as I said, my father was a New York City policeman, and he, once he retired, found himself, in a sense, on the other side of the police barricades in terms of civil disobedience, in terms of witnessing against the war. And he said one of the things that turned him around was reading all of the stuff that he could, principally in the New York Times, about the war. And so I think that is interesting to think of. I mean, just information being a sort of change agent in that way, and more doubts coming up. And finally, my parents got to the point where they were lifelong Republicans, and they headed up a Republicans for McGovern movement in St. Petersburg. Needless to say, it never became a national kind of consensus, but they were involved in that. Had a little local media value, but that was about it. So I think both from my parents' stance, and as I mentioned a few moments ago, they always seemed to have a concern for the other and for social issues. And also from Chap and Claudia Morrison here on the campus, who've also expressed a great deal of concern. Another facet of that was that they, Chap and Claudia, had founded this organization called Community of Concern, and it had actually, I think, four focuses initially, and one of them was concern about community, concern about social justice on a local level, and some concern about international issues, but principally it became taken over I think, by the kind of anti-war movement work. I mean, and that is connected, of course, to other issues that had local implications, but I would say the principal thrust of the organization then became a kind of anti-war work. And they left not too long after I came, I think within 2 years. And so they sort of said, well, you have to do something with this. You know, somebody has to do something with this. And so they sort of thrust it at me, and naively I assumed some of the organizational burden, which gets to be a whole other issue in terms of administration and so on, but really became a leader in that sense by being faculty advisor for community of concern here on campus. That became a focus.
When you arrived in 1968, were the students opposed to the war at this point, or what was the students' reaction to United States involvement in Southeast Asia?
I would say that initially there was not a large presence of anti-war sentiment on campus. If anything, as was true around the country, people believed what the government had to say and were quite committed to staying the course, to stopping communism, to all of the things that were kind of trotted out. If we don't stop it here in this tiny kingdom, it's going to spread across the globe and so forth. And it's odd to hear about those things, especially now in the era of glasnost, where there is all kinds of crumbling. But I think people believe the standard things, as I did initially myself, and then it just became the difference between appearance and reality, a shattering of the possible reasons extended. But I would say it was largely a sort of a belief in kind of government presence, although people were concerned about going themselves. I mean, that was another issue. And I think gradually, as information came around, as more and more people were sort of standing up, others became more informed.
Was there a working organization in opposition to the war when you arrived at Youngstown State?
Yeah, I think the Morrisons had in place that framework through Community of Concern, and they were really working on that issue, and perhaps stood out a little bit more because the cause was not popular at that point. And even throughout most of the war, there were those who represented a different camp. And the All Americans for Freedom were pretty active on campus, for example, and were fairly hostile and in opposition to, and so forth. So I think there was always a presence of those who believed otherwise.
How many students would you say were opposed to the war when you first arrived here?
Boy, that's awfully hard to measure. I don't think I could. I mean, I'm not being hesitant or coy or something. I really would have no way of knowing, especially if you're going to try and mark some progression here. I just don't know.
In the faculty, how many members of the faculty? Was it a popular movement? I talked to Professor Morislav, and he made mention that most of the faculty members who became opposed to the war came through it through more of an intellectual way of looking at the war itself, looking at it as a nationalist conflict instead of a battle of good versus evil, communism versus democracy.
Two questions there, one of numbers, and the other, how did people come to this? And I would say that most faculty members probably did come to the stance that they did out of lots of reading. I know that Morris Slavin is a big New York Times reader himself, and this is not a session which is an advertisement for the Times, but frankly they did do wide coverage. Yeah, people came to know that, you know, sort of Ho Chi Minh was like the George Washington of his country and so forth, and that the people we were supporting seemed to be quite quite venal, quite self-seeking, and did not certainly have the fervor that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese had. So I think all you had to do was witness that on television and do some reading about it, and a critical stance helped to move you in the right direction. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the people who felt the way they did became activists or something. I mean, I think some people were willing to sign petition. As in any movement, there are stages and gradations of possibility. And some people were willing to do more than others. At first, here there was a kind of atmosphere that it wasn't appropriate to be doing this. And President Pugsley would send out things from Barron's Weekly that supported the U.S. government position and so forth. And in fact, at one point, he tried to get rid of me. I was not a tenured faculty member. And he had a complaint about me from a student who had pieced together a letter, sort of cutting it out of newspaper headlines. I mean, to me, that's a sign of a whack nut right there, right? But she accused me of all sorts of odd things. Being a lost shepherd, misleading the sheep. I mean, there were no specific mm-hmm. accusations. It was really kind of a nutty letter. But he sent it to my department chair and felt that she ought to act on it in some way. And happily, her name was Margaret Pfau, Dr. Margaret Pfau. She was a very upright woman, and she said, well, I think this letter belongs in the wastebasket. And I said, well, apparently he doesn't, and so if you do, maybe you could send him a note to that effect, a memo of some sort. So I think the climate here was one where it wasn't so popular to be anti-war, but in fact there were a number of people who stood out, and I think in one of the jambars I gave you, there were a list of names mm-hmm. Of a number of people. I guess I would say that was about 25 to 30 people who were willing to stand up and be counted as professors resisting the war by working in moratorium activities, by giving speeches, and so forth.
As an anti-war activist, what events at Youngstown State were key to the peace movement?
I think there were a number of them. We were talking about some of the events that seemed to be crucial or key in terms of the anti-war movement. I think one of them was the initial sort of speak out where faculty members got up, like a teach-in that we had on the Persian Gulf crisis just last week. And that is where faculty members prepared position papers. I know that Dr. Shipka did one, that Dr. Slavin did one, that Dr. Sternberg did one. I organized, put up the framework for it in a sense, and got the place. And at that point, the equivalent of Kilcoyne was Jones Hall with a large theater space in the middle of it. And that place was packed, the auditorium in Jones Hall. And it was packed with people coming and going and speaking. I'm sorry that I can't recall the specific year of that, and perhaps some of your other respondents can, but that was, I think, one key event. Other events like that went on as the war went on, and sometimes they were called by students. For example, U-Helm, a principal spokesperson for the Vietnam Vets Against the War, he was himself a Vietnam vet, called some outdoor meetings, and there are pictures in the jambar and so forth of this, in the area just beyond Kilcoyne at this point. And so some outdoor arenas were used for things like that. There was a large march downtown to Central Square at that point where the monument is now. Again, that's a transformed space, but it was a large area where would it be Market Street and the Central Avenue downtown anyway came together in a four square kind of place, and it was the chief traffic node downtown. The mayor at that point, who was Jack Hunter, I think, said that he couldn't possibly close traffic downtown at noontime for this, and when we went to meet with the mayor, there was another professor with me, perhaps it was Elizabeth Sternberg, maybe Morris Slavin, but Dr. Shipka's father at that point was head of AFL-CIO, Al Shipka was his name, and we had an ACLU lawyer, Alan Kretzer, who is now the lawyer for the Board of Trustees at the university, having nothing to do with that, but he stood up for a lot of ACLU causes. And he went with us also, and we went to speak to the mayor, telling him that this was our desire, and could we have a traffic permit, basically, to do that, a permit to march and to do that. And he resisted all along the line until Al Shipka made quite a persuasive, quite a moving speech about, are you going to tell me that, you know, American boys are dying in Vietnam and that we can't stop traffic for 15 minutes downtown in the city of Youngstown? I mean, he was trying to make sort of comparable notions of sacrifice, and so I think the traffic problem became reduced. I think it was also crucial that we had a lawyer, because this was a free speech issue too, a speak out kind of thing, and somebody who represented something other than the university community, a union leader with great prominence in town, because of course the steel mills and so forth were still a big deal. So so I would say the presence of those parties, and I guess one of my skills was being able to bring together various people for particular kinds of things like that to get some things smoothed over. And student leaders and myself, we went, you know, downtown and other faculty members, and one of those demonstrations was 1,500 strong. Hard to believe that, you know, that many people and so forth, but there were pictures in the Vindicator, obviously, and so forth. So we had a gathering downtown. And again, lots of different factions related to the war were represented. I mean, again, Vietnam veterans against the war, some people who were basically sort of peace types and nonviolence kinds of it, and then some people who were chanting "Ho ho Ho Chi Minh, the NLF is going to win." Mm-hmm. So,
you made mention of Al Shipka's role as a.
I should mention some other things that I think were crucial. Trips to Washington, D.C., okay, organized trips to Washington, D.C., and there were people in the community who were organizing that, but I remember it, and I was organizing it, and I can remember that at one point there were five buses of people that we had going to demonstrations in Washington, and there were numerous ones of those, okay, so that's another thing that I think was crucial to the movement here, people being willing to, you know, ride those buses all night and go out and become part of large demonstrations, principally in Washington, D.C., of course, although, you know, much later there were some in New York and San Francisco, I mean, all around. Bill Jones was a person who was involved in that. He was an important student leader in the anti-war movement, as Joan Kronansky was. Probably Chuck Toskis is a name that should be mentioned there also. I mean, there were a number of people who were chiefly involved. John Greenman was another one. He headed up the air war show in 1 year. When the air war intensified, he became somebody who did sort of demonstrations. He constructed a booth that had a sound show in it that was sounded like planes coming over, and we had some, you know, a series of presidential voices linked over that. We had leaflets to hand out, and Sharp Lumber Company, he was a person who was against the war at that point, and he owned Sharp Lumber Company, and his name escapes me at this moment, but he gave us the lumber to construct an outside booth. There were also theater kinds of guerrilla things. We also had a large display related to the tiger cages, which was a particular form of torture where somebody couldn't stand up and couldn't sit down. The South Vietnamese government was using this on their own citizens. And so we had a number of kind of pictorial displays of demonstrations of different kinds of things. And some things that I had nothing to do with. I mean, some students were interested at one point in attacking the ROTC building and that sort of thing. But I, of course, I mean, I had nothing to do with that. I was a faculty member and had an official status. And And in fact, some students didn't let me know about some of their plans at all because there was a division, I think, between what they thought I could sanction, and they were right. And so that became something that students did in a kind of entrepreneurial sense. They did it on their own.
You mentioned Al Shipka as part of the labor community that offers support to the anti-war movement. Was there much in the way of other community support to the peace movement?
Okay. I would say that there were some other labor leaders. Ed Mann, one of them. John Barbero, another one. As I remember, there were leaders in the black community also. People like Ron Daniels and others whose names I'm not fixing on at this point simply because I can't call them up. I can't remember them. There were people like Roz Sims in town who were engaged in Peace Council work. And I'm frankly, again, not remembering the date when the Peace Council began, but that has been, I think, a strong movement for change that has sustained itself. It is still doing lots and lots of activities. In fact, even tomorrow has a press conference at OCA related to our national priorities. People like Ellen Robinson, for example, being a very strong and good spokeswoman on many of these issues. So yes, there was a community component of some labor union people, although I should say that most of the labor unions that we saw were witnessing for the war, very pro-war stance, and this was a time when, you know, sort of hair issues became, you know, crucial. If college students with long hair were going trying to leaflet at mill gates, which occasionally happened, males with long hair, there would be, you know, sort of shouts and taunts and jeers and things of that sort. So I would say that most of the labor community in town was in fact pro-war, with the strong exceptions of those good leaders that I have mentioned to you. And Ed Mann is still doing much of that work in terms of social justice issues, in terms of civil libertarian issues, et cetera, et cetera. So there were some very strong and forceful spokespeople with regard to anti-war work, but I would say the largest commitment of the union community was pro-war. But those two sectors, there were the Peace Council, aspects of the black community, aspects of the university community, that formed a coalition of resistance to the war.
Mm-hmm. When was the peak of the peace movement at Youngstown State University?
As I told you when we first started talking about this, I have kind of lots of individual impressions, but didn't keep a journal and don't have a clear sense of the mark of years. I guess 70, 72, those years would have been crucial. But I'm sorry again that I don't have it marked in any very distinctive way. I have a sense of a kind of grab bag of activities taking place, and of course they took place over time. One big event on campus, as you saw from the Jambar, was the closing of the library, the shutting down of classes in some ways for one of the moratoriums that we had. And a person who was courageous in that regard was George Jones, who was head of the library, because he did decide against President Pugsley's stipulation that no classes would be shut down, that people could simply go to these activities during their free time or when they weren't in class. He very courageously shut down the library for an hour at lunch, and I can remember that people had offices over there, and so some people were angry about it, but some people, history department people, Sid Roberts, for example, were pleased at the courageous stand that he had taken. And I think Hildegard Schnutken also was appalled about the war and, you know, sort of stood out at that point, too. And my then husband, my first husband, William Budge, was the order librarian, and he stood out. And so So there were a number of people who, you know, who honored that. But that was a courageous act, given he was an administrator, and the chief administrator in the organization had said, don't do this. I think he felt, I mean, he was older and he was going to retire, and he stood for his conscience in that sense. One of the things that I should mention in terms of people standing for their conscience, too, is that somebody who was a conscientious objector on campus was Dave Beacom, B-E-A-C-O-M, and he was, I think, a witness for many others. That is, people were emboldened by his experiment, by his stance, and so forth. And I would love to know what happened to him. That is, what he's doing at this point. But he was a bold person to stand up, a very meek person in his philosophy of life, but a very bold person in standing for his conscience in that way, for actively resisting. Because, of course, you know, some people went to Canada, some people deserted once they were in the service, and many people, you know, put in their time and did their commitment. On a related issue, I was just looking at a videotape of Ron Kovic today. As you know, he's the Born on the 4th of July person. I mean, he wrote that book, and the movie is based on that, and so forth. And he is now asking that we stand up and be counted against the movement in the Persian Gulf, against all of our troops there. And he said, didn't we say never again? And what's happening? Where are we in terms of witnessing? So, political commercial about that.
Okay. Do you remember the peace moratorium of 1969? From what I read, that was like the key.
The big one. Okay, well, maybe that's the one that I sort of was saying, 70 to 72, maybe 69 was the one. I think that's probably the one where we talked with Al Shipka, where we went downtown, where there was, you know, this whole range of political sensibilities represented from, well, not from the right to the left, but from center to left in terms of those who were speaking out about the war. And that was much more student-oriented in that at that time, too.
Was it difficult to get students involved in the anti-war movement?
I don't think so. I mean, I think in some sense self-interest was motivating them. I mean, you know, who wanted to go over there or to have a brother or a boyfriend or, you know, what have you. And I think it became a popular thing to do. I mean, I don't know exactly how to express it, but there were still groups that were not part of it. To a large extent, I think, for example, the fraternities and the sororities stood out from that. So there were sort of two camps, you know. They were kind of, oh, the long hairs and the freaks. They were the politicos. They were the people who were part of this whole idea of resistance, the anti-war movement, and there were, you know, sort of ordinary students who were also involved. But quite often, of course, people look different if their political stance was different at this point. Sometimes now it's very hard to tell. But I think for the most part, fraternities and sororities were in another corner, although there undoubtedly were some individuals who crossed the bridge between them. But I did hear a funny story just recently from Tom Fournier, who was a soldier in Vietnam, and he came back, and he was on campus, and he was not an anti-war person. And he said he used to get so pissed off that there were these people who were sort of blocking his way or making these demonstrations, and they were sort of know-nothing, almost adolescents as far as he was concerned. You know, it's like, get out of my way, twerp kinds of attitudes about that. And he said that was often his notion, you better not stand in my way if I'm going to class, right? Mm-hmm. And so he kept that kind of stance. And he said he was living in a household where this woman, Joni Kronansky, whose name I mentioned before, was living. And he said to me just last week that it wasn't that she was so convinced about the political stance from the outset, but it was more convenient to join Community of Concern than to join the ski club where you had to invest in equipment. Mm-hmm. And he said she actually sat around sort of debating ski club, Community of Concern. And I said, well, I find that hard to believe. But I think it may be that people at one point were not so absolutely convinced, but as they got drawn into it with more information and frankly more activities, would would get a firmer commitment then to the movement. That was a story told by him. I wish I had Joni's perceptions about what that was. Unfortunately, she's no longer in town. But I thought that was amusing, that perhaps some people came from not such a firm political stance, but just the notion of which group shall I join. Right? Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'll take a little second here.
Sure.
I'm gonna flip the table.
You made reference to President Pugsley being opposed to the war. Did that carry
no,
out?
Not opposed to the war. Opposed to people who were opposed to the war.
Okay, excuse me. Did that permeate all of YSU administration? Was YSU's administration in opposition to, or in favor of the war?
I suppose in some sense it's hard to say. One of my impressions since I've been here is that administrations have gotten better all the time. In terms of my way of looking at things, President Pugsley was not somebody who had typical attitudes that you might associate with a university president in terms of issues of free speech and so forth. He was very concerned about what students might say on placards, for example, signs that they would carry around, like "fuck the war." Mm-hmm. He was very distressed about the use of that word, and wanted that stopped. Well, it's really not possible to stop that sort of thing. I mean, it's not as though I were officially sitting around writing signs of that sort in my office, but if somebody does that kind of thing and brings it to a demonstration, as I said, there were a whole range of possibilities. But something like that distressed him very much, and he would talk to editors at the Jam Bar about such issues, and shouldn't somebody be stopped, for example, from writing "fuck" on his forehead if he want, and the answer to that is no. We may find it offensive, but it's an extension of sort of free speech issues. I don't think he was informed on some of those things as he might have been, and consequently, it was a very difficult time for him. I think he felt threatened. He felt as though things were sort of out of control, and how do you keep things reined in? Mm-hmm. And I think there were other conservative presidents in different places, but. I don't know whether that permeated other aspects of the administration, but they were. I think there was an interest in keeping everything very regular, keeping classes sort of uniform, doing what you were supposed to be doing, business as usual, in other words. And some faculty members and some students felt as though this was such a disruptive event that there ought to be some disruption to business as usual on campus. So, I can't say whether it permeated the administration. I mean, I would suppose that people had differing opinions within the administration. They certainly weren't vocal about that, though.
Were there any actions undertaken by the Youngstown State Administration at this time that made you feel threatened?
I mentioned the earlier one where President Pugsley was willing to believe whatever bad anybody said about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the dean passed along instructions at one point to his assistant dean to go around checking to make sure that people were in class on moratorium day, that is, that they hadn't suspended their classes. So again, it was this notion of business as usual. And I think that's kind of a humiliating position for somebody to be put in, you know, sort of the whole monitor,
mm-hmm.
right? And frankly, I don't know what repercussions there could be. Perhaps a note to the file.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I don't think somebody could be dismissed over such an issue. But once you were in a separate camp, I think President Pugsley was willing to believe that you were not to be redeemed somehow. But again, happily, I had a department chair and others in the department who were very supportive. And most life is lived in departments at the university. The president does have an influence, and the deans do have influence, and so forth. But most life is department life in that sense.
Do you remember the names of the dean and assistant dean at that time?
Well, Dean Yazbiak has been here for a while, I think he's the one who was saying that Assistant Dean Smith was the person who was to go around and check. The dean before Yazbiak was Dykema,
mm-hmm.
and so I don't actually remember, because there was an early period of transition there, and so I don't actually remember who was in command at that point, but I think it was Yazbiak. You know, following orders from on high, the whole notion of obedience to authority to some extent, and if you're in an organization, it's very difficult to resist that. And I think there's a large American tendency to conformity in any case. Coupled with the materialism that we have, it's a terrible cross, right? But yeah, I think that... And we never had the range, the political spectrum, for example, that might come out of Europe or even Canada. I mean, when I was in Europe this summer, the number of newspapers representing different political points on a whole wide spectrum was very marked. And that was in France, and I think it's true in Italy and in many other countries, too. It's not so true here.
Do you remember, Professor Schutz made reference to, at one point, I don't know if it was Professor Pugsley, had a cameraman on top of a building.
Yeah.
Do you remember what event this was for? Or?
I think he felt that there had been some threat issued to the university. My impression is that that it may have been at another kind of transitional period where anti-war work was linked also with black liberation in some ways. And I think one of the things that President Pugsley was most frightened about related to Black Students United in revolt, asking for things from the university, which again was kind of an extension of some anti-war standout kinds of activities. And of course the women's movement got a large impetus from the sorts of demonstrations and activism that were sustained during the war. So I see those three things as kind of, you know, flowing out in various ways. And I think the time that Pugsley was most alarmed and perhaps had alerted police and somebody told me even had, you know, somebody with a gun on top of the place where he was. I mean, policemen, obviously, official figures. But I thought that was largely out of fear related to Black Students United, who had combined with some of anti-war folks and so forth, asking for changes within the society here. I mean, the notion of looking abroad and seeing that things need to be rectified and that our government had to deal honestly with us on some of those issues had a parallel. There was symmetry then with needed changes in society here, especially as a number of the people coming back were black veterans and weren't going to submit to the hierarchy that they had experienced before. So a student movement of two sorts in that way, I think, and really three when I talk about the women's movement too coming from that time.
Are you aware of any national anti-war movements or national groups that took positions in opposition to the war, having presence at Youngstown State?
Well, I think we took ideas from lots of places, like a kind of grab bag. Student Mob was one of them, the student mobilization to end the war. We had their literature and activities. Indochina Peace Campaign was another one, and had lots of literature from them. In fact, it wasn't until years after the war was over that I finally got rid of all my literature with Nixon's face on the cover and so forth. And hurt my back, actually, trying to get some of them out to the curb to be taken away by the garbage. But that was particularly Indochina Peace Campaign stuff. And they brought to campus, we brought to campus through them. Jane Fonda was, I think, in Cleveland, and Tom Hayden came here, I know because he stayed at my house, and he came here to speak to groups, to encourage the work that was going forward, to be a kind of local visiting hero in a way. So Student Mob, Indochina Peace Campaign. The Quakers always produced material, and bless them for that, the American Friends Service Committee, and they have had a long historic tradition against the war. You know, even in World War II, they were the only people who stood with the Japanese who were going to be put in relocation camps. So they have historically such a strong tradition of that. They worked with Indians in Pennsylvania and so forth, and had peaceful coexistence, didn't put locks on their doors, etc. Let me speak up saying hooray for them. Clergy and Laity Concerned was another group, and Bert Cantrell, who was a campus minister here, worked with material from them, and again, we're talking about material that could be distributed in the form of leaflets, posters that might be put up, activities suggested, like here are seven activities that, you know, might be done in response to this, here are letter writing campaigns that you might encourage, here are petitions that could be done, here are these photographs of the tiger cages, here are, you know, children, here are monks burning, I mean, whatever kinds of media sorts of things, here's a suggestion for a press conference. So, yeah, we did rely on national groups. National SANE was another one of the groups that was involved there. And Fellowship of Reconciliation. I mean, really, all the national groups would send suggestions as they did on other campuses, and we would, you know, use what we could, sort of picking and choosing. And some of that activity still goes on. I mean, SANE Freeze is doing things in terms of the Persian Gulf crisis, Lots of places. The Youngstown Peace Council is doing lots of stuff. So there are still groups, you know, out there. Again, the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, doing lots of stuff with regard to that. And I might add to that, Bert Cantrell, who was here and a figure and often stood out, was particularly appalled about Kent State. And Jackson State followed up on that, and we shouldn't forget about that. Somehow we always talk about Kent State and Jackson State. Black students shot, beaten up, and so forth. So Bert Cantrell left here to join SANE, but anyway, he was a conspicuous figure. Father de Blasio with the Newman Center, and the Newman Center was also a place where a lot of activities went on. And Father de Blasio and others, I'm forgetting the name of another priest who was there, counseled people who wanted to be conscientious objectors, as Bert Cantrell did. There were also other kinds of activities. Many more people used to go to the Newman Center, and that also became a nucleus of people who were opposed to the war from a kind of Christian witness. So I think that again, that's another phase, and I'm glad when you mentioned organizations, I had forgotten to mention the religious presence on campus, which was very important. And again, Jim Ray has continued that in terms of CCM. on issues such as racism. If one wants some conscientious objecting counseling, you can go there. The clinic, the free clinic. I mean, lots of ways of service to the university. So I think the ministers and priests who have been on our periphery have often been involved in social causes that were important to the university. I think important to the life of the university, a different kind of social life, a different kind of intellectual witness.
What national or local events stand out as major and significant during the period of the anti-war movement?
I think I answered that in the earlier question of moratorium things.
You mentioned the one man, Kent State, had a big impact. I'm looking more on some national scope or world event that had a profound impact on you from this period.
Well, I think I was always more touched by the very human dimensions of things, rather than particular, say, military campaigns or something. I mean, I guess the air war had a big impact, and that was later stepping it up in that sort of distance, and using the kind of distancing prose that we did too, sanitized prose such as protective reaction strike, when really we meant, a raid to bomb and so forth. But I think the things like the tiger cages, the things like monks burning themselves, and there was also an American who burned himself as a witness, and his name was Morrison, also at the Pentagon at one point. To think that somebody would so believe in something that they would just willingly die for it. I mean, there were people dying in the war, but that seemed to be almost willy-nilly. It wasn't such a consciously chosen thing. I think the witness of some people who were willing to go to jail for that, the witness of some people in the religious community, the Berrigans, for example, pouring blood on draft records and draft cards and so forth. Acts of civil disobedience where people would pay the price, they would pay the consequences somehow themselves, were very moving to me. So more so than particular historical events or the Tet Offensive and so forth, I would say that the human consequences and the human costs seem very real.
What was the impact of the Kent State shootings on the anti-war movement at Youngstown State?
Well, I can remember people calling me, and they said, well, they're shooting students at home now. They're doing this here. The war has come home. In some ways, I don't want to say it didn't seem so surprising to me, but a little bit the outrage seemed so surprising, because there were many soldiers who were being killed in Vietnam on both sides, and of course, many people didn't want to acknowledge sort of the other side, and all of the deaths that were there. There were later photographs in Life magazine of people who had been victims of napalm and so forth mourning their children. And I can remember people saying, well, those people don't feel grief in the same way we do. I mean, there was a kind of racism implicit in that. And there was a kind of classism, I think, being so angry about Kent State, middle class students, versus lower class people who were becoming cannon fodder. So I think that, that doubleness, well, people had been killed all the time. I mean, yeah, I'm sure Kent State is appalling, and maybe you need those events that are kind of trigger events, that are catalysts, that are precipitators for people to get animated around. And I was recently at a peace conference where they were singing some of the old songs, and Four Dead in Ohio, of course, was one of those. So I think it became a catalyst event, bringing the war home, that sort of stuff. But frankly, I saw it as a continuation of what had gone on, and a certain classism and racism that we hadn't, really thought about in terms of the way we were looking at other things.
Did this event have any impact on the student body here
Oh yeah, I think immediately people were willing to sort of walk out. They could see it as this connection just down the line. They knew the Schorier family, some people here. I think there was immediately an outpouring of outrage. I mean, just, you know, people willing to walk out of class and what are we going to do next? And what can we do that's significant enough to stop this machine, the war machine, in that sense? So, yeah, I think that people were spontaneously doing things, calling for a demonstration, asking people to leave class, getting out into a central arena, not waiting for national groups to say, why don't we try this as a new strategy, why don't we try that as a new strategy, but, you know, but sort of doing whatever they felt propelled to do at that time, and some of it was an outpouring of a demonstration kind of thing.
Was there any violence ever at Youngstown State during the anti-war movement?
It's hard for me to say. There were obviously peripheral instances of violence where somebody who was quite vituperative about being pro-war and somebody else who was on the other side might be involved in some kind of fisticuffs around the edge of a demonstration. For the most part, people were willing to stand and act as marshals at demonstrations, though. So people who were specially trained in sort of peacekeeping techniques willingly served, as they did nationally, when people went on national marches and so forth. So there were those kinds of folks who would sort of appoint themselves as marshals, in that sense, at various kinds of demonstrations. I did hear much afterwards that there was going to be an attempt at one point to burn down the ROTC building, which was the Pollock House, and that there was going to be, and again, this is years afterwards that I, you know, that I heard about this, and I was surprised, but they were going to do something like carrying a coffin over that would have something inside of it that could be ignited pretty easily,
mm-hmm.
and then do that, and there would be a conflagration that would follow. It never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said that part of what was restraining some of the students said that would get Alice Budge fired for sure,
mm-hmm.
because they wouldn't believe that I wasn't connected with it somehow. But in fact, at this point in history, I can say,
mm-hmm.
I never knew about it until sort of ages afterwards. So that was, I guess, a near event, one that didn't happen, that people were persuaded not to do. Because I think as time went on, frustration levels went up, and people said, well, what are we going to do next? What can we do now? If they're not listening to us, what can we do? And so there were, I think, an escalation of tactics, even as there were in Vietnam. I mean, again, that has a kind of parallelism, too. And there was much more going on nationally with SDS and the Weathermen and so forth. I mean, really confrontational and disruptive and anti-establishment and war techniques. That we had to bring down the system was their message.
Is there anything else, or looking back, what changes would you have liked to see instituted in your role as an anti-war activist?
I don't know. None? I don't know. I think one of the things that I find very positive about it is that it was an emerging time for me in terms of movement into the political and social justice arena, and I never gave that up. So I became, you know, sort of co-chair of Ron Daniels' mayoral campaign in town. I continued doing this. I did social justice stuff. I mean, now I'm heading up the Peace and Conflict Studies project here at the university, and working with Minority Student Services Committee and Minority Access Success. I mean, I very much see social justice kinds of issues tied up with peace concerns. There's no way of sort of divorcing that. And I think that once you become an activist, you may change your style a little bit, but I think that you sort of keep witnessing throughout your life in some ways. I mean, I don't think that you can turn away from that. And to me, not that I would have changed it, maybe I would have begun earlier somehow, but it was that movement which led me into many others, and let me not forget the women's movement also. but I do think the continuing, sustained presence of a need to witness, of living beyond the subjective cage of the self for others in some way, is very important. And that's particularly important when there's a kind of national violence, as that was, but it's also important when there is a kind of subtle violence and racism that permeates our society. So I would say not regrets, but positive feelings and a continuity of my life. And as I said to somebody recently, I was trying to talk to people about these issues. I was speaking to a group at the Unitarian Church, and I said, you ought to stand up and do something in some sphere, because it finally feels so good. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is that return for yourself, and the connection that you feel to others. It feels good to do it.
Is there anything else that you think is important to add that we did not cover?
No, I probably will think of something, of course, after you go. Mm-hmm. But that's very typical. Just, I think, the important, heroic, courageous sort of stand that people took, the importance of some figures like the Morrisons at the outset, to help get others involved in being able to stand up for issues of conscience. I think that's probably about it. I could look through my eyewitness history of the Vietnam War and discover others, I'm sure, but no, I think that's about it.
Thank you very much.
Sure,
for your time.
You did it just in an hour, too. What a...